we had seen some cracks in the food system, if you will, that had given us some heartache.
Alaska farmers step up to supply eggs as the national shortage drags on. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a Juneau resident gets her regalia back suddenly 2 weeks after it was stolen.
It was just shocking. I started crying on her and she was like, oh, sweetie. She was like, don't cry.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Fentanyl and other illegal drugs are causing mass destruction and have killed hundreds of Alaskans. Local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies have partnered to address this scourge. Last year, law enforcement seized millions of fatal doses of fentanyl, arrested dozens of drug traffickers, and worked day and night to hold those that deal dangerous drugs accountable. You can help by submitting anonymous drug trafficking tips to the AK Tips app or online at akhidta.org. This message sponsored by Alaska HIDA.
Several Anchorage municipal employees are accusing Mayor Dave Bronson's administration of monitoring who's visiting the city ombudsman's office. That's according to a memo sent today from Ombudsman Daryl Hess to the mayor and Anchorage Assembly Chair amid an investigation of allegations by the former city manager against the mayor. In the memo, Hess wrote that multiple employees have contacted his office alleging that a city executive said the mayor's office is downloading copies of City Hall surveillance footage to see who's accessing the ombudsman's office and interacting with the assembly members. The ombudsman is an independent office charged with investigating actions made by the municipality and the Anchorage School District. Both the assembly and the ombudsman's offices are on the first floor of City Hall. The allegations come a week after former municipal manager Amy Domboski, who was fired by Bronson in December, alleged that Bronson had taken numerous unethical and unlawful actions. Domboski said she had also filed complaints with the ombudsman's office about some of her concerns. Hess's memo states that several employees expressed fear that access to the ombudsman's office was being watched. They also claimed that the alleged statement from the unnamed city executive about downloading surveillance videos was, quote, an attempt to intimidate them to not contact the ombudsman's office, end quote. In a statement today, Bronson spokesman Corey Allen Young said the mayor's administration is investigating the allegations and taking them very seriously. Hess, the ombudsman, said he felt obligated to refer the matter to the municipal prosecutor's office to determine if any laws had been violated. Assembly members were meeting in executive session today and set to meet again tomorrow to discuss their legal options for addressing the allegations by Domboski. Anchorage city auditors say their initial review of actions made under disgraced former health director Joe Gerace are also raising some concerns, and they plan to dig further. Michael Chadwick is director of Anchorage's internal audit department.
Well, our review of invoices and interviews with the health department staff suggested that Mr. Gerace had obligated the municipality prior to having the vendor's work authorized through the proper contract processes.
That essentially means Gerace had put the city's money on the line before contracts were done properly. This year, auditors are following up with a look into health contracts and grants made under his tenure. Gerace was appointed by Mayor Bronson and served in the role for just under a year before resigning in August of 2022, shortly before an investigation from Alaska Public Media and American Public Media showed that he had fabricated many parts of his resume, including military service, medical credentials, and education background. Chadwick says another big audit will look into sole source contracts from the city's purchasing department. The department released the results of a previous sole source contracts audit last February and said this follow-up audit came at the request of the mayor's office.
I'm not sure exactly what their concerns are. I just know that they wanted us to do a follow-up audit of the sole source contracts and to make sure that they were being reported properly and that contracts that were over $30,000 were being sent to the assembly for approval.
Scrutiny of sole source contracts has intensified in recent months, and again with the allegations recently from Domboski, the former city manager. Cartons of eggs are hard to find at grocery stores in Alaska and around the country. But local food champions say Alaska farmers can provide a more reliable and sustainable supply of eggs anyway. As KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports, they say the ongoing shortage is a good time to think about strengthening our local food ecosystems.
From the excitement in Kim Keck's voice, you might think she's just come across a pot of gold in the parking lot of a Kaladi Brothers in Soldotna.
Do you have 3 dozen?
I do have 3 dozen.
Keck is picking up her 3 cartons of eggs from Jacob Burton of Poyama Farm in Sterling. She grew up with farm-fresh eggs on the East Coast.
The eggs are a beautiful yellow, golden yellow yolk. They are not watery, they're fresh, so you...
Keck says you can't get anything like these in the bigger chain stores. These days, you might not find any eggs at all in most grocery stores. There's an egg shortage in Alaska and around the country, driven by the avian flu and high production costs for companies. The shortage is driving prices up and, in some cases, keeping cartons off the shelves altogether. The shortage has impacted Anna Skolin. She runs The Goods, a sustainable grocery store in Soldotna. They sell eggs from peninsula producers alongside local produce in jars of fermented veggies.
I would say there are two very direct consequences that we are experiencing from that situation, which is
one, she says more people are coming in and asking for eggs.
And then the second part of that is that we're actually getting fewer eggs because our local producers who typically bring us eggs are being intercepted. Friends and neighbors are buying them before they get here.
Eggs were already in high demand at The Goods. Skolin says they get 15 to 20 dozen local eggs a week, and they'll routinely sell out, even in normal times. But she says the shortage is sending a lot of people into stockpile mode.
The response that I see most often is, I got to get all the eggs I can because there aren't enough eggs.
But Skolin hopes the shortage in the big stores instead makes customers think critically about their shopping habits and how they can build up the food systems in their own communities.
Being involved and learning about where your food comes from and maybe kind of shifting some mindsets about expectations of what food should be available when.
The last few years have shown food systems nationwide to be fragile, but producers at home can skirt around some of the issues caused by shipping woes and avian flu outbreaks thousands of miles away, says Erica Lujan, manager of Blue Market, aka in Anchorage. Blue Market gets its eggs from Gardner Farms in Wasilla. Lujan says sourcing a local supply keeps money and jobs in the state and also reduces emissions associated with transport.
But we're also seeing local farmers are better able to keep eggs in stock.
She says they've been selling eggs fast at the store and seeing a lot of new customers. She says the high demand shows there's a lot of room for more local farmers.
Just as people kind of recognize what the food landscape is with this shortage, you know, we'd love to see more farmers come in. We'd love to still support the farmers that are there and just make sure there's enough eggs to go around for everybody.
That sort of ethos is what inspired Jacob Burton and his family to level up their hobby farm last year and start selling eggs, poultry, pork, and lamb.
And we had seen some cracks in the food system, if you will, that had given us some heartache.
Today, Poyama Farm has about 200 chickens and 80 ducks. It does egg pickups every week at the coffee shop. And Burton says it's been an opportunity for communities to rally around food together.
And what we found is it's actually just a better way to live anyway, to produce your food locally.
This is the time of year the farm's production is at its lowest. Burton says the farm can't meet all the need from customers, including the goods.
Right now we're turning away probably half the people that reach out to us, or if not turning them away, at least, you know, they have to wait until the eggs are available.
But to him, that enthusiasm is encouraging. He says people are thinking more about where their food comes from, which he sees as a progression forward.
We're trying to express to people that it's really important that you find local sources of poultry and eggs specifically, but just local food is really important.
Because Kim Keck is doing her part as a poultry patron. She says eggs are in high demand in her household.
The last 2 eggs my husband had this morning.
As expected, her resupplies met with a lot of enthusiasm from her family. After the parking lot exchange, she follows up in an email. My grandson is making brownies for his 6th grade class at readout as I type this, she writes. Then, one word, happiness. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a meeting between school officials in Ketchikan and Metlakatla helps heal a rift.
I think that everyone is looking forward to moving forward and developing a good relationship.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming.
Searchers are looking for two 18-year-old men reported overdue this week on a snow machine trip from Kotzebue to Norvik. Alaska State Troopers identified the snow machiners as Josiah Ballett of Selawik and Thomas Brown of Ambler. The two men told friends on social media that they were leaving Kotzebue at midnight Monday, according to troopers. Messages at about 3 a.m. located them still in Kotzebue, possibly en route to Norvik, a community roughly 42 miles to the east. People from Kotzebue, Norvik, and Selawik, plus troopers, have been searching area trails and coastline by foot and by air. Troopers say the search continued today. More than 2 weeks after her house was broken into, Nethka Kuge Taja Revels says her stolen regalia has been returned. She says the items were returned anonymously by someone who refused the reward she offered.
It was just shocking. A woman ripped open the garbage bag and was like, "This is yours, right?" And I started crying on her, and she was like, "Oh, sweetie." She was like, "Don't cry." She was like, "Let me go grab another garbage bag. We'll wrap it up for you, and you can be on your way." And that was it.
Revels says she was contacted by someone who said they bought the regalia from someone else who was walking around downtown Juneau trying to sell it. She says the person who returned the regalia learned it was stolen from the attention the theft got on social media and in news coverage. Revels says she's still missing more than $15,000 worth of stolen possessions, but she says she's at peace.
But everything else compared to the regalia is just stuff. We can replace her or I can move on. The regalia, having it back home feels like having a family member back home.
Police arrested Juneau man Anthony Perry for the burglary earlier this month, but at the time, the items were still missing. Perry was charged with 5 counts of burglary related to the break-in. The next hearing for the case is scheduled for March. Last winter, controversy erupted over a basketball game between Ketchikan High School and nearby rival Metlakatla. Ketchikan's pep club had planned a country theme night, and there were students dressed in cowboy hats, boots, and flannel shirts. Some students shouted racial slurs, according to investigators. Indigenous fans from both communities took the theme as an offensive reference to old tropes of cowboys and Indians, as the Ketchikan team hosted players from Metlakatla, Alaska's only reservation. Ketchikan School District has since apologized and pledged to do better in the future. And just recently, Ketchikan School Board made the trip to Metlakatla to address the rift left between the two communities. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, the meeting was the beginning of what Metlakatla officials say is a necessary healing process.
It wasn't just about a basketball game or a theme.
Me personally, I've seen that it was evident in both communities that there is a deep wound.
That's Gatgita Hike, the president of Metlakatla School Board, speaking on her own behalf about the damage caused by a country night pep club theme.
In order for the healing to begin, it's something that needs to be talked about amongst everyone, including leaders in the community.
That's what happened on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when a handful of members from Ketchikan School Board made the trip to Metlakatla. There was just one item on the agenda, to discuss the deeper problems exposed by that basketball game last winter. Hike says the time was dedicated to exploring ways that the two towns can keep finding ways to bring their students together.
I think that everyone is looking forward to moving forward and developing a good relationship.
Stephen Bradford is the president of Ketchikan School Board. He says officials in both communities agree that it's time to build a closer relationship.
We realized that there had never been a joint meeting of the two school districts that anyone could remember anyway. And we just felt like it was a very productive session just because they are so close and we are so intertwined.
Bradford says the two boards also discussed some recent basketball games between the Ketchikan Kings and the Metlakatla Chiefs. He says both boards agree that the atmosphere has been positive at tournament and regular season games.
And I think the same feeling was expressed about the Clark Cochran because the Metlakatla Miss Chiefs had participated in that tournament, and everything was a great atmosphere and a lot of fun for the kids.
Tom Hewitt, a Ketchikan school board member, says the meeting was a reminder of just how closely connected the two towns are.
We have a lot more in common than we do that separates us.
Hewitt says he'd like to continue to forge closer ties with Metlakatla's district.
So I think what I got out of it was Ketchikan and Metlakatla are very closely connected, almost, you know, one larger community, because a lot of folks from there come over here, vice versa, very closely linked. And our two school districts are both facing a lot of the same challenges.
School board member Diane Gubatayo also made the trip over. She describes the meeting as a chance to show appreciation to Metlakatla. Bradford brought gifts to Metlakatla's board, including a few framed pictures and a wooden art piece commemorating Alaska Native civil rights leader Elizabeth Baratrovich, created by Ketchikan students. Metlakatla's board members took them on a tour of Metlakatla High School and the new vocational technical buildings, including an inside look at the school's scuba certification program. Gubatayo says she was grateful for the opportunity.
I think it was a very important event for one board to honor another and to build relationships with another as board members to board members. And we all acknowledge that the most important thing in our efforts and discussion, it's all about the students and what's best for our students.
And Bradford agreed, at the end of the day, it's not about basketball. It's about the students.
And you could tell that there is great friendship and camaraderie between the players themselves. Sometimes it's the adults who get in the way.
He says the two boards are ready to move forward together. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
The city of St. Paul is at risk of losing its emergency medical services. Phil Zavadil is the city manager for the Pribilof Island community. He says money is tight on the island right now, and that's mainly due to the recent closures of Bering Sea snow crab and Bristol Bay red king crab.
With 60% of our tax revenue gone with no crab season, you have to make those tough choices.
The city's economy is about 90% dependent on the snow crab fishery. Zavadil says they are expecting about a $2.5 million loss without the snow crab and king crab seasons. The island community of about 350 people has one EMT who is currently off-island, and Zavadil says they've got enough funding to employ them through the rest of the month, but after that, the remote community will have to rely on local volunteers who don't have the extensive training or knowledge of a certified EMT.
Essentially, if something were to happen, we'll go grab somebody in the ambulance and take them to the clinic, and that's pretty much the extent of what can be done.
The city hires EMTs rather than relying on volunteers through the police force, which they had done previously. That's because St. Paul mandated vaccines for its city employees in late 2021, and the entire force resigned. Zavadil says it costs about $160,000 a year for the EMT contract. Currently, he says the city has a budget deficit of nearly $1 million. The community was expecting major economic losses when the crab fisheries closed. In late October, St. Paul's city government declared a cultural, economic, and social emergency that's meant to anticipate effects of climate change on the island's subsistence and commercial fisheries, as well as the impacts the crab closures will likely have on the community. Zavadil says he's working to avoid overspending now, which could lead to mass layoffs and bankruptcy later on.
We're in a difficult spot. As I talk to our staff and others, I have to caution us of overspending because we don't know how long the craft crash is going to last.
The city is relying on donations to keep its medical services. Zavadil says they've received enough funding to keep an EMT on the island through the month. Two people died within 24 hours in Skagway last weekend. Illicit drug overdoses are suspected in both cases. KHNS's Mike Swayze reports.
On Friday night, January 13th, shortly before midnight, Skagway police officer James Michaels responded to a 911 call about an unresponsive male.
Upon arriving on scene, there was evidence of possible illicit drug use.
Michaels says Narcan, used to reverse the effects of opiates, was administered by EMS, who arrived within seconds of police.
Life-saving measures were in progress. I was doing chest compressions while EMS was pushing Narcan, and we continued to roll that way until the on-duty provider showed up and took over.
Those efforts were unsuccessful. The victim was pronounced dead at the scene by the on-duty medical provider at the victim's residence. Then, on Saturday afternoon, at a little after 4 p.m., another 911 call came in.
This time it was for an unresponsive male, and we responded to the scene, again, did life-saving measures, and were unable to obviously save his life. And again, there was signs of illicit drug use present at the residence.
Police do not have confirmation that fentanyl was involved in either case, but Michael says signs of illicit drug use at the scene led police to believe it was a contributing factor in both deaths. The Skagway Police Department immediately opened an investigation and seized a large number of pills. Skagway Police Chief Jerry Reddick says they believe the pills are laced with fentanyl.
We will be sending them off to the crime lab to get a confirmation of fentanyl. All preliminary research and talking with the drug task force, everything is leading to the facts of them being fentanyl with the markings, and the color coding is corresponding with everything that they have seen.
The department released a photograph of the confiscated pills on its social media page on Sunday. The pills are designed to look like prescription drugs, like oxycodone. But with their bright colors, Skagway Mayor Andrew Cremata says they also look like candy.
It's not unlike looking at a Skittle or those little sugar candies that people get on Halloween. So if you're a 4 or 5 year old child, I'm sure the distinction can be difficult.
Police would not comment on the ongoing investigation about how the drugs got to Skagway, but as Mayor Cremata says, they are looking for help from the community. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
Like many areas in Alaska, Petersburg has a housing shortage. Their housing task force has been working since the fall to find ways to create more available housing. The task force requested $55,000 in funding from Petersburg's Borough Assembly on Monday for a study known as a housing needs assessment. They say it's an important step to securing grant funding for housing projects in the future. The Assembly approved the full $55,000, but not without some disagreement. KFSK's Rachel Cassandra has more.
Some members were skeptical that the Assembly needed to spend the cost of a mid-sized luxury car to figure out that Petersburg had a housing problem. Here's Assemblymember Tom Fine-Walsh.
I have a hard time justifying $55,000 for an outside company to come and interview us and just ask us what we think we need and then charge us $55,000 for our answers. That seems ridiculous.
In a later interview, Assemblymember Bob Lynn says he has a deep respect for the task force and their work, but he says he doesn't want to throw money at the issue without a crystal clear understanding of what the borough would get from the investment.
My hesitancy is that I'm worried that we're going to go down the road and keep spending money and spending money. And at the end, it pushes the borough into us having to, one, take a much greater responsibility in housing, and or two, raising mill rate in order to pay for something along those lines or redistributing wealth.
Feinwalsh ultimately came around and the assembly voted 4-2 to approve the $55,000 study. Assembly members Donna Marsh and Bob Lynn voted no. It will be funded by leftover COVID relief money. Jalen Pomrenke is housing director at the Petersburg Indian Association. She says the assessment is a first step to getting grant funding.
A lot of the ideas that the Housing Task Force has been coming up with rely on funding from outside sources, and a lot of those funding opportunities require a housing needs assessment for any type of application. So we've decided that this would be the first step to getting these ideas off the ground.
She says the study won't just look at housing needs. She says it will be a more holistic look at housing assets and shortages.
I've been calling it a housing needs assessment. I feel like the better way to identify it is a housing and needs assessment, where they'll take stock of resources in Petersburg and specific programs that are running here and kind of tell us where, you know, you're doing really good at this. You could do a little bit more on this side.
Pomrenke says the assessment will also be a resource for nonprofit organizations working in Petersburg.
It's not just something that the borough can utilize. It's something that other entities in Petersburg can utilize as well, too, when they're making grant decisions and applications. It's a key to a door that we couldn't open without it.
The task force has explored available housing grants, including some through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. In one grant, the federal agency offers communities up to $500,000 to transform unused stores and warehouses in town into low-income housing. But even the assessment likely won't be enough to win funding for Petersburg housing projects on its own. The borough's Community and Economic Development Director, Liz Cabrera, says the borough may also need a housing grant specialist later on.
Because these are highly complicated grants, applications that you're going to be putting forward. Generally for HUD, they are really complicated. And then the other end of it is implementation. You know, there's no such thing as free money, and those grant funds come with lots of strings.
Anchorage-based Agnew Beck Consulting will put together the housing needs assessment for Petersburg. It's the same company that completed the borough's comprehensive plan update in 2016. In Petersburg, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And finally tonight, a correction. A story yesterday about the fatal polar bear attack in Wales misstated what time of year polar bears are expected in town. Polar bear expert Jeff York says they're expected from December to May. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Mike Swayze in Skagway, and Rachel Cassandra in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.